Accession number 31411, reel 2.
I say, I suppose if I had any oil in my lamp, if I knew anything about anything. I mean, I think by the end of the war, I knew a lot about running ships on convoys. But I really, or by the time I got released from the R&R, I thought I knew everything. You know, Jack the Lad. I knew nothing about anything other than that. But if I knew what I know now, I would have ended up as a, I think. Would have tried to anyway, Trinity House pilot or something like that, running on the East Coast, because I had that sort of background, and it was second nature to me. Anyway, that's beside the point. So you used to have a lot of leavers and a lot of joiners. Escorts, you asked about escorts. Well, there was, as a norm, there'd be two ships from the Rosyth Escort Force, and they were V&W wear class destroyers, or later we hoisted in a lot of these four funneled
Americans,
all named after the places that were in, and they were a really pain. They used to break down and they weren't very good really, but we had them as well. There'd be trawlers like these, and fair mile motor launches, and if there was a warship coming down, a small warship, she'd join in as well. But I suppose a standard convoy would be when we're the senior officer, when the captain, or bowman left and went off to HMS Golden Hind in Sydney as a shore job, and the chap who took over, he was only a lieutenant, so we went from the senior ship to the junior ship. But when we were the senior ship, we always led the convoy, and there'd be one astern. There'd be usually trawlers, MLs as you got sort of south off East Coast, and then additional escorts through Ebode Alley. Now, Ebode Alley was, I suppose, from about Cromer down into Harwich, that sort of area. And you'd have additional escorts from the 21st Destroyer Flotilla, which were Hunt class destroyers based at south at Sheerness. And the 16th Destroyer Flotilla, which were V&Ws, but sort of genuine, you know, not modified, at Harwich. Now, they got very much involved in the Charnos and the Gneisenau and the Prince Eugen when she came chasing the Worcester, same name as the training ship, actually, got very badly beaten up, as per that. Now, there is actually, I'm sort of digressing, you probably already know, I just brought you that, because there is a V&W class association.
I think they meet on board here, actually.
Eh?
Yeah, I think they meet on board.
Well, you know about them. But I mean, they could tell you a bit about the East Coast, because quite a lot of their ships were, this is just only the sort of interim one, but it's got the blokes' names on it there. But they'd be about the place as well. So there'd be quite a lot of escorts. And, that's right, we used to have a fighter escort of usually Spitfires. And there was a very early form of fighter direction that we used to run ourselves with an unreliable radio telephone set, RT set. But an added complication was they always seemed to be Polish pilots, so it was a bit of a nightmare.
So that was where you could control the aircraft.
Well, we tried to, yeah. but they couldn't understand what you were saying, and we couldn't, blooming set used to pack down half the time. So it was a bit of a shambles. So I suppose that was basically what used to happen going down there. Now, on the work up to D-Day, the tide was turning a bit, and you get masses of of Allied aircraft, particularly during the day. You get the Flying Fortresses, the American Air Force Flying Fortresses, escorted by these Thunderbolts, flying over a hell of a lot. We used to have to pick up, occasionally they come limping back and they'd, you know, pick people up on them. And at night it'd be the British, you know, Bomber Command going up. You could only hear them, not see them. But an awful lot of fighter activity flying all over the place during the day. Then as D-Day approached, we thought, well, we're going to be in the front line of this lot. We were quite sort of looking forward to it, really. And I remember I had the middle watch. I was the navigator by then. And we were just about off Cromer when I, at 4 o'clock, and there'd been terrific aircraft activity, and we were bringing this convoy down. And when I woke up in the morning, I turned in at 4 o'clock and said, oh, there's been an invasion. And I thought, oh yes, where's it going? So we brought the convoy into London and then took it out again, and then turned around and came back again. So we never actually heard any guns fired, but that was the closest we got to D-Day, which we didn't believe. It was a bit of a disappointment. Then we used to do convoys through the Channel occasionally, and
so were you shelled by the German guns when you...
No, we expected to be, but we weren't. But the constant problem really was mines and keeping the mines swept. Right when the Midget submarines came out, German small submarines, they were a bit active in the North Sea. That we had ships sank idly just about the day after the war ended. But that was the sort, and the navigational hazards, combined with the dark, you know, keeping station, and it was wrecks all the way down the east coast there. But we used to navigate on wrecks. I mean, with the ASDI, or the sonar as it was later called, you could ping on these and get a bearing off the wrecks. And I mean, you could sometimes see the mast during daylight. So I used to fix it on the chart and put it on, and you could, in the fog, you could. We did. I can very well remember fog. You used to get a lot of fog, and you used to have to anchor the whole convoy. Anchor the whole convoy. The trouble was, and get the barrage. I mean, we used to tow barrage balloons. That was the other thing. There was two: the Roebuck and the Reindeer. I think they were GWR Channel Island cargo ships. You know, it used to be the railway steamers. They used to sail from Wales to the Channel Islands. And, well, they didn't during the war because the Jerry's were in the Channel Islands. So these two ships were balloon barrage ships, amongst others. I remember them. They used to be there as well with their balloons.
Were these the ones that had a Royal Air Force crews on them all?
What, for the balloons?
Yeah.
Spec, so, yeah. That's right. With all sorts of funny gadgets. Anyway, so if you had to anchor in a fog, that'd heave all the balloons down. Otherwise, of course, they'd be poking out. Sometimes they'd be sitting down. So that used to be an issue, which was another sort of form of escort, I suppose.
How long would you sit in the fog for?
Until the fog went.
So it could be quite a long time.
Yeah, but I do remember we did make our way right down from, it's a long time ago now, from probably about Lowestoft into the Thames, just pinging on these wrecks and sort of thought, that wreck that I've marked that one on the chart, that must be the one. So it was all a bit crude, really, but it did it. And then we had this QH thing, which had been the latest, well, the earliest, the first type of Decker, and it had been an aircraft and thing. I think you probably know the story about the carrots, don't you, and the bombing. I mean, for a long time, it was said that, well, people eat carrots, good for night vision.
Yes.
I mean, there was, I suppose the Germans knew really, but we thought they didn't or hoped they didn't. The Pathfinders, they did accurate bombing. And the story that was put about was, well, the bombing was eat carrots and it's good for nitrogen. What it was really was this QH thing, which has now evolved really to GPS and, you know, all, that's what it was. It was the very earliest days when we were involved in the damn thing. So all those sort of things used to go on. Then we did have quite a long changes of the officers. What we carried was, well, I was a midshipman for a start, but when I was promoted sub-lieutenant, we didn't have another permanent midshipman, because when I was a midshipman, I was doing the navigation. So we didn't have another midshipman, but we, not another R&R midshipman. In fact, in the Rosyth Escort Force, there were four of us from the Worcester of the same term. I was in the Westminster, another guy was in the Wollstone, another in the Winchester, and another in the Valorous. And I've still been in touch with them. Well, the ones that are alive, one of them in the Winchester is stayed in the RN and then went to the New Zealand Navy and now lives in Auckland. Another one's dead. Another one was a master in Haynes Line and lives in Helston, and it's myself, so we're sort of more or less of that. But we're all midshipmen together in the Rosyth Escort Force in different ships. But anyway, what we had was the CO, who originally, well, was the first one was Overy, that's before I only knew it by name. The second one was Bowerman, who's the ex-submariner. The third one was Dyer, Johnny Dyer. Now, he was a smashing bloke, really. DSC and Bar, he was. He was an upper yardsman. He'd been a commissioned bosun, two-striper, but a really good bloke. And he'd been, I think he'd been senior officer of a group of coastal forces and got a DSC. He'd also been, I think I put the write up in here, he'd also been the first tenant of the Sulmarais, which was a ship that, involved in the Shandor. Mm-hmm. And he got a DSC there. And then he came to us as a lieutenant, and he was a really good boat. Really good boat, and I really got on well with him. I don't know if he's dead now, but he was a good chap. Quite different from the previous one. Anyway, it's the captain. Then there was a first tenant. Well, when I joined it, the first tenant was an RN VR lieutenant from HMS Caroline, which was Belfast. Then there was another RNVR sub, an RNVR sub, no, it was an RN sub lieutenant as the navigator, and when he was promoted to lieutenant, he went to another ship, and I took over from him. So it was an RN sub lieutenant as navigator. There was an RN VR gunnery control officer. There was two RN VR watchkeepers. A warrant engineer and a gunner. That was it. That was the lot. And it stayed the same complement but different people. And the RNVR lieutenant, who was the first lieutenant, left and went and was lost in the Pacific War. And he was replaced when he left with an RN commissioned gunner. He was a good boat. So the CO was a commissioned bosun. The first lieutenant was commissioned.
How was it? Lower deck with officers who'd been commissioned from the lower deck, were they fine about it? Or?
No problems in those days. I mean, no, the relationship was pretty relaxed, really. I don't mean indiscipline. I mean, we had the bad blokes who used to have to be disciplined, and I mean, one of the greatest crimes was breaking leave.
Mm-hmm.
That was what really got the captain neurotic, and I'm not surprised. I mean, it was a fairly tightly manned ship, and if you gave leave till midnight or 0700 or something like that, yeah, that's what it was. And if people were late, bad, that was a really bad. We didn't get sort of fights and drugs and beatings up and disorderly conduct ashore or anything like that. Nothing like that at all.
Would you say she was a happy ship's
captain? Yeah. Yes, definitely. And a bit of leave breaking, I suppose. I can't think of any other really thing. And I mean, it used to escalate, and someone just kept it, and they get made second class for leave, and they leave at all, and all. Just be bloody late.
Because it must have been really hard work, because I'm guessing you were constantly.
Oh, yeah, it was hard work. I mean, we did, during my time in Iraq, I did have a fortnight's, 10 days leave once we were refitting. I had 10 days, the rest was boiler cleans, and we used to boiler clean about every 6 weeks in Scythe. And I used to get the night train from Waverley to King's Cross and then cross and down to Bromley. But I'd only be home a couple of days and then back again. So, yeah, it was. And there was no courses or training or anything like that. When we got back into harbour, there'd be an attack teacher, it was called. It was a dome, you know, the dome where, it's a dome, and they used to project.
That's where they had aircraft.
And that's right. Mm-hmm. We used to go. And there was another one, an anti-submarine thing.
How useful did you find those?
Well, the anti-submarine one I did think was useful, really, but the other one was a bit of a pain. I don't know. The anti-submarine one I used to seem to go to quite a lot. Every time we got in the harbour, we had to go in and do that. And there were all these new things coming out, like Foxer, you know, for the...
That's the decoy, isn't it?
Acoustic torpedoes. And stepper-side propulsion, all sorts of things being... innovated. Every 5 minutes you had to go and sort of practice. So there we are, and the war sort of went on. Now, when the war actually ended, we were coming up the East Coast on the FN convoy. And by the time we got into Rosyth, of course, the immediate partying and everyone was so, not we weren't, but everybody ashore was so sort of overhung, they could hardly take our lines. So we missed all that. But then we immediately sent over down to May Island, further forward, to take surrender of submarines. Mm. And it was a beautiful June, wasn't it? Beautiful day. And it was a lovely calm sea, and we stopped off May Island, nothing happening, and all of a sudden up popped these blooming U-boats, about 12 of them.
So this was where they'd been told to go to a certain coordinate.
Right, yeah. And it was incredible, really. The case, you know, the conning towers opened up, they tumbled out, sat on the upper deck, these boats on the casing, brought out deck chairs, you could see them sitting down there smoking cigars, waving, drinking champagne. And I thought, well, what a bloody farce. They're just like us, aren't they, really?
They must have been relieved it was over.
I think so. I mean, the U-boats really, they were terrific heroes, just on the wrong side. And Dönitz was a wonderful bloke, but again on the wrong side. I mean, the U-boat crews did a wonderful job for Germany. And, I mean, they nearly beat us in the winter of 42-43, and they nearly beat us in 1917. And they... Same now. If they if you bring a look about, you've only got to stop the supplies. Well, they don't really go, gets me onto them. Merchant service, what they've done to the merchant service. I mean, okay, it's all foreign crews and it's foreign ships, foreign built ships. And I think strategically, what's happened to the British shipping industry is a national disgrace. Mm. From the shipbuilding, the ship training, it's a bloody disgrace. Absolute disgrace. And we're so vulnerable.
I don't think they could even do what they do in the fault, what they did in the fault. Mm.
And I mean, even out in the Gulf Wars, they've had to charter an awful lot of stuff, didn't they? And ship train up and track. Because I stayed in the R&R altogether for over 30 years, and I used to be involved in naval control of shipping and all this sort of stuff, and very much involved in those sort of things in the NATO days. And it seems to be an absolute disgrace. Now, but that's drifting away a bit, isn't it?
Did you meet any of these German sailors when you brought them back into...
No, we didn't, sadly enough. And I've always wanted to come across some since. But after we took this surrender, we then had to go to Norway. And we went straight over to Norway. And quite a lot of the ships of the South Escort Force went into Norway. And they were stationed in various naval Norwegian ports as communications centres. But we were the sort of trot boat, and we went straight over to Stavanger, and then took mail and dispatches and people up and down around the ports, and went to Narvik, Trondheim, Bergen, Kristiansand, Oslo, up and down the inner leads, where we took a pilot. And I was a navigator then, with a pilot on the bridge, so it was ever so interesting. We'd be going up and down around, then back to Rosyth and then back again as a sort of trot boat. And of course, we were popular in Norway, I suppose we should have been, really. And they wanted to sort of fate us and things like that. And we thought we were going to pick up a lot of souvenirs, but the SAS had got in there just before. The only thing there at all, they had cleared the lot. But we used to, it was in the middle of the summer, wasn't it? And dark nearly all, light nearly all night. So we used to steam until getting too dark. So we spent most of our time going from place to place. But as soon as we got in the harbour, they'd come swarming down and sort of, oh, come ashore. And it'd be, and I remember the Norwegians say, well, you come ashore and bring bread and butter and fine salad cream. And they used to, we used to go ashore with bread and butter and hazard, and they'd lash us up with lobsters and champagne. And we used to go. And, but then we'd be sailing, I mean, it was very tiring, really. In fact, one day with old Johnny Dyer, I swear blind it was not my fault, we'd all had gone ashore and been fated by the Norwegians, and we had to sail about, let's say, 5 o'clock in the morning. And I was on the bridge with him, and of course the captain says, well, ring on main engine. So you sort of ring them on, in other words, you ding, ding, ding on the telegraphs, and so that if you move the telegraphs, the engines in the engine room is. So you have to say, ring on main engines. And he never did. Well, no, he didn't, because I mean, I used to go. Anyway, let go forward, let go aft, and he says, slow ahead. And of course, nothing happened. And I couldn't say anything, but it wasn't me. There you go. So we were all a bit overhung. But that was that. But it was good, but unfortunately, sad really, because we really looked after the ship. And on the going across the North Sea, I thought, all right, I'll start polishing. I used to, when I was on watch, used to scrape all the grey paint off the voice pipe, start polishing and this and that. And of course, we got back to Rosyth eventually, some weeks after the war, and they said, right, that's it, stick her on the mud up at Grangemouth and strip everything out, and that was it, finished. Ever such a shame, didn't keep one.
Yeah.
So there we are. From there I went myself to a Bay class frigate to go out of the Far East. She was building in Harland and Wolves, and I was navigator there, and signal. In those days, the navigator was the signals officer, the communications and miscellaneous divisional officer, the radar officer, all those sort of things put together. Anyway, I went to the Traumatic Bay, it was, and she had those twin 4-inch again, and a Bofus with a Hazemeyer projector, which was a radar controlled thing, was quite the latest thing for those days.
How did she compare accommodation wise?
Oh, she was a lock class frigate with different armament, and I did various courses and things like that. And then we went down to Devonport, Portsmouth. We'd about to go to the Far East, and they dropped them. So we then went back and picked up some U-boats and towed them. The Mark 21 U-boats. They were the very latest thing.
They were the big electric boats, weren't they?
Well, they were going to be able to do something like 20 knots submerged or 7 knots, which helped us because, I mean, our ASDIC sonar could really only cope with about 7 knots. And these would have knackered everything if they'd have got operational. But they didn't. And so there were 6 of them. 2 went to the French, 2 went to the Yanks. We had 2, and 2 went to the Russians. Well, we had to tow the one of the Russian ones. And we went into, picked it up at Londonderry, and towed it, so-called, to a place called Liebau, which was up the Baltic, sort of in Latvia. And it was a bloody nightmare. We got in the middle of the North Sea, and the steering jammed on the U-boat, and that parted the tow, and a hell of a gale. So we sorted that and took it into a side, and they couldn't fix the steering. They just jammed the rudder amidships. So off we went again. And eventually, we got up to Liebau, and it was. It was all frozen over and horrible, and I mean the welcome we got was sort of about minus 50 really. I mean they wouldn't let us off the ship. It was terrible really. And there was a commercial harbour and a naval harbour, and we had to drop the tow in the sort of inside the breakwater, and the U-boat went over to the naval harbour. And we went to the commercial harbour, and our engineer went to the U-boat, and he was eventually did what he had to do, and he was coming back to us, and they just arrested him. We had a hell of a time there, really, a hell of a time. They did take us ashore one night to the local officers' club and filled us up with booze and things like that, and kept on drinking, and toast to Stalin and Churchill and all this sort of thing.
Was there a feeling that the Cold War was beginning then? Do you think?
Well, I'd never even heard of the term. It was a feeling of great apprehension. And it was most miserable, really. And my chum, who was then the Admiral Anti-Submarine Control Officer, an RNVR sub-lieutenant, or lieutenant, he might have been that, was a hell of a lad for the girls. And we went to this dinner, all sat in places, and of course he was missing. And I thought, oh Christ, he's up with. And suddenly the door opened, and a sheepish look, and something with a bird round his arm came creeping in. It was this boat, and of course she was hustled, probably a centre of the room. So that would put a bit of a damper on things. So we never went ashore again, and eventually we left and came back. Then they paid the damn thing off. And then, when I came home, they said, I went up the Admiralty, and they said, well, that's it, we'll release you to the Mercy. I said, I can't do that, what am I going to do? No, where am I going to come out? Well, you can sign on here as an envol, which was the end of the present emergency, which I signed quickly, because I didn't know what the hell to do. And the next thing I found was out on a troop ship going out to Malta. And I joined the 8th Minesweeping Flotilla in HMS Thisbe, Algerine type minesweeper. And I spent a year out there as navigator, and we were clearing up all the mines between Cape Bon and Sicily, and that thing when the Saumarez was mined and the Albania.